RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hi, welcome to RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. And with me today is Tanner. Hi, Tanner.
Hi, Dusty. How's it going?
It's going really well. It's been a long time since I've recorded any podcasts, and an even longer time since we've talked.
Yeah. It's been nice. It's nice to be back in the RPGLL studio virtually. I can see the live band over there.
Oh, yeah. So, Tanner, you and I have been gaming together.
We have. It's been nice. It's hard as an adult to find time to game, but we've managed to figure it out a little bit.
Before you reached out about one-on-one gaming, I had gone maybe 2 years of very little gaming, pretty much just Martin's game for me.
Right.
But aside from that, I hadn't gamed in forever, and you reached out with an idea to play some one-on-one stuff, and that's been so fun. And we've done it like, you know, I think it was at 9, because I think it was you've run 5 and I've run 4.
Yeah. We managed to set a couple things up. It's been nice.
It's been great. And the one-on-one game, I wasn't sure I would enjoy it. And certainly, and we'll talk about, well, I hope to record an episode on each one of those games. And certainly a couple times you've made a comment or I've made a comment, gosh, I miss having a group to have ideas. I think you specifically made that comment about the investigative game.
Yeah.
But I think one-on-one by and large has been wonderful for clarity of purpose.
Yeah, and it's nice because, you know, things are always being driven forward. There's very little. I'm sure you and I have both had these kinds of games where either the players, because of unclear direction, like kind of end up spinning their wheels a lot. And there's been none of that really in any of the games that we've played, which has been nice.
Yes, it's all meat and bone. There's been very little, you know, extraneous filler fluff.
Yeah. And it ends up being where like you do like a 1 hour and 45 minute game, and then it feels like you've been playing for 4.5 hours though, just because, you know, we're both always on all the time as either the GM or the player, you know. It's, you know, you can never sit back really and let somebody else take the lead for a little bit, which is, you know, a little bit of a double-edged sword depending on what the kind of player you are, but it has been nice for getting stuff done, you know?
So we've got show notes. We've collaborated on show notes. But I'm going to catch you off guard with something not in the notes.
Uh-oh.
As you know, at RPGLL, we always like to model feedback and taking feedback well and giving feedback respectfully but kind of fearlessly. Mm-hmm. And then also accepting feedback with the intent with which it's given. So from all of our games, not referring to any specific game, what's your biggest piece of general feedback for me? What's the thing that's irked you or annoyed you, or what would be your most blunt, direct feedback to me as a player or a GM, one of the two you pick?
That is a great, great question. I'm looking at the list of games that we've been doing, and I think, so we've been playing a lot of, not exclusively, but a lot of sort of, you know, traditional, for lack of a better term, D&D genre type adventures, you know. And I think going back and referring to maybe a good checklist of what makes a good D&D style dungeon or old school style dungeon or adventure or setting, I think is something that you could maybe work on. There's a lot of stuff that, and you definitely got better as we went along, but there's some really good stuff online about like what makes a good dungeon, like multiple levels, a monster that you can't kill, things to run from, things to talk to, all that kind of stuff. And I think that you've been recently firing on all cylinders on that, and I think it would be good to keep that going.
I appreciate that feedback.
Yeah.
I'll take it and I'll amplify it. I have a mental block about running other people's adventures.
Right.
If it's a one pager, I feel like I can read that and then kind of fill in those bones and have fun with that. But by and large, I can't read a large adventure. So I tell myself, oh, I like to make up my adventures.
Right.
But then I'd fall into the trap of I'd pretty much write the adventure for me. Like, here's all the things that would happen with all the things that I would choose to do, not thinking through all the things that anyone might choose to do.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody is truly great at that. I mean, if you're writing it without like rounds of feedback from like editors or something, and it's just for like a home game, you know, like all you can kind of do is come at it from your own mind and your own brain and what you think would work and what wouldn't. So I don't think that would only be a problem if you didn't also have the flexibility to think on your feet and flip the script when things go differently than you thought, and you're good at that too. So.
Well, still, this is a thing that I want to get better at. So let me say thank you for the feedback.
Yeah, no problem. Do you have any for me?
Ooh. When I asked the question, I knew you were going to reverse it on me, but I still didn't spend any of the time while you were talking, like thinking of my own to give you.
How dare you listen to me instead of just thinking about something else?
Let me see. What feedback would I give you about your games? As a player, the sardonic nature of trying to kind of outsmart the NPCs and have fun with the NPCs comes through. And I think it comes through in every character that you've played so far and in some of the NPCs that you play. So, and sardonic, I think, is good. It's fun, but I think it's 100%. So if I were to give you a specific challenge, it's like a fun thing you might try. I challenge you to try to have like a fully wide-eyed, completely guileless NPC.
That's a really good point. I don't think, as far as like personality archetypes, I have a huge diversity when it comes to NPCs or player characters. That's a good piece of feedback. I'll think about that.
Awesome. Let's talk about a specific system in a specific game. So you ran first.
I did.
And you knew about this game called Scarlet Heroes that I have come to deeply love, and I thank you for turning me onto it.
Yeah, Scarlet Heroes is really, really cool. It's published by Sign Nomine Publishing, which I believe is Kevin Crawford, who is a little bit more renowned for his game Stars Without Number and Worlds Without Number, which are really great old school sandbox games. But the pitch of Scarlet Heroes is that it is a system that lets you play a one-on-one D&D style role-playing game, a very, you know, old school D&D style role-playing game. But the whole thing is that the one player character is as powerful as a party of adventurers would be in a sort of regular rule set, which is just a genius idea to start with. But they kind of even take it one step further, and like many great old school revival games, it's completely compatible with any old school revival game. And we'll see that as we do some different games later on. But it's just a really flexible system. It's really great. The math is very, very interesting. They make Thaco make sense. I don't know if you remember me talking about that, but that was like the first thing that like blew my mind. Like, they made ascending AC make sense,
or
descending AC. Yeah, so like an old school D&D, like an armor class of 3 was better than an armor class of 5, and the way that this does it is that you're adding all your modifiers, and instead of trying to beat an armor class, you're trying to beat 20, and so you're adding the enemy's armor class to your roll. I don't know if this is too in the weeds, but when I read that, I'm like, oh, this guy understands how to make something playable.
And to summarize what that means, what that enables, if you, like me, have this mystique in your mind around the older modules like Ravenloft or Tomb of Horrors or Keep on the Borderlands or whatever, and you want to run those, but you don't want to get together, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 people, this system lets you run it with no modifications to the adventure itself and to the monsters in the adventure. It lets you run it in Scarlet Heroes. You can run a dungeon for one person playing one character with no modifications to the adventure text. And that's huge.
You have a comment in the notes here that it makes your one character feel like Batman. And I was just thinking about that kind of more deeply. And what it does is that it lets you, because we've both played it and run it at this point, right? In some future games, you run it for me, and I take my first turn playing. But one thing I noticed is that while you're very capable, it doesn't make it feel less deadly or dangerous. So like Batman, you know, you are kind of a badass and you can handle what would be a formidable encounter for a group of other adventurers in a classic game. But like, if you let your guard down or you get some bad luck or if you make some bad decisions, like you are not invincible. Like your character, it's more about, you made a really, really good point about it. It's about like investing your hit points sort of, and as opposed to losing them when you get hit. Do you want to kind of talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. The way the damage works is you kind of run any incoming damage or outgoing damage to the same table where it runs like, you know, 1 to 8 damage, and that gets reduced from anywhere to like 0 to 3 damage. And it means you're losing fewer hit points every round, which means it's more predictable that, okay, I'm probably not going to go down this round.
Right. You're never going to like accidentally take 5 damage on a turn. You're taking 0, 1, or 2 99% of the time.
Yes. So, and that's what I meant by invest hit points, because it becomes this game of like resource management, where if I'm on the wrong side of a room and I'm surrounded by enemies and I start taking a lot of damage, I might die. And my death is as hard to happen as a TPK, but TPKs happen, so it can happen. But at the same time, if I'm running low on hit points, I feel like I have a good sense for, okay, I could take on 1 or 2 more fights before I need to retreat and rest.
Yeah, and the way that we're healing, or the way that we're playing with healing, is pretty by the book, I think. I don't think we went too crazy with like healing effects or anything like that, which is to say that like it's kind of hard to get HP back. Like resting or whatever, you get like 2 HP back or something after a fight, but like you really... You know, you have a good sense of what you're spending is kind of, you know, you're spending the cards that you were dealt at the beginning of the encounter. You know, it's not swingy, it's not crazy in the way that a lot of old school games can be. And yeah, I think it's just really, really clever. And the whole basic idea is that as a player, when you take damage from monsters, like you said, you're kind of running it through a table, which reduces it, and that deals damage to your hit points. But as a player, you are dealing damage to a monster's hit dice. So a 1-hit die, or like a level 1 monster, a 1-hit die monster will have 1 HP, or a 5 HD monster will have 5 HP, you know? So you're basically doing a level's worth of damage every time you deal a point of damage in the system, which is just like a really, really clever way to like fix the asymmetry and make it so that it can be a one-on-one type game.
Yeah. And again, you're Batman. You're not Superman.
Yes.
But you're Batman.
Yes. Yeah. It's great. And you really liked the character creation, right?
I love the character creation. Rolling stats, easy. Choosing the skills, easy. Buying equipment, easy. I love the choosing the skills in particular. With skills, you choose a skill, and if you have a certain number of points you can spend on skills, and you can get skills from your background, you can get skills from your class, but you can also kind of just make up skills. But you write in your skills, and if you want to spend more than 1 point in a skill, you get that skill plus. Mm-hmm. So the way you spend your points on skills feels so much better to me than, you know, a thief having the set of like 8 things, right, from picking locks to disabling traps that all require like percentile rolls. Instead, you just have these skills that you've selected that fit your character that are a little more flexible, but not overly flexible. Like, your character can't do everything. You can't justify anything into a skill check.
Right. And we're pretty good about policing that too. Like, so for example, like, it's not like you have a 1 in 6 chance of picking a lock or moving silently like some old school games. It's like your background is art thief. You have 2 points in art thief. So if you want to do something and you think your background of being an art thief would apply, you know, you get that bonus. But it's a conversation. And I think it's really nice for a one-on-one game because it's really easy to keep the other person honest, you know, because if I was playing that kind of system with maybe 4 players and, you know, Greg says, well, you let me use art thief, and but Jim over there, he has town guard and you're not letting him use that much, you know, like, you don't, the rulings are easier because it's just one, it's one-on-one, it's a one case sort of ruling that you have to make. And very early on with your character, Bellman, we'll get to that, with like, we decided and kind of defined early on through rulings, like what your skills can be used on. And it wasn't a surprise later if I said yes or no about anything, right?
No, and we both played that pretty consistently.
Yeah.
But with the good comes the bad. And as much as we both really like Scarlet Heroes, there's one thing that we both independently hate. What is that thing?
The spell names. I haven't read too deep into it, but the game comes with a pre-baked setting called the Red Tide campaign setting. And I think it's meant to be sort of a East Southeast Asian fantasy, which is very cool. So thumbs up to that. But I think to me, it was kind of a miss that all of the spell names are feel like they exist in that specific setting when the rest of the game is advertised as sort of a, you know, play any D&D adventure with this game. Let me read some of these spell names. There is a spell called Tongue of Hidden Conversing. It is a level 1 cleric spell. You've played a lot of D&D in your life. What is the spell?
Maybe speak to dead. Speak to the dead.
Wow, you got it right. That was a good one. Yeah, so like they're all, you know, pass through hells. That is protection from elements. Like, I don't, like, it doesn't do anything for me, I guess. I'm not trying to blow up the dude's spot because we both really do love this game, but I would even love more a second edition that is more generic and lets you kind of tinker with it. And I guess the argument is that, you know, old school games, they're easy enough to tinker with and you can make your own spells or use spells from any other game, but it's that's like the one part of the game that's a very clear miss to me, for me personally.
And I agree with that. Like, choosing spells, I couldn't just read the spell titles and feel like, in fact, as I bought the print book to be able to play with you the very first game, and I read a bunch of it, and one of the first things I said to Susan as I read this book was, wow, I'm going to be a fighter or a thief because I don't even know how to choose. I would have to read the entire spell selection, all of the text, all the descriptive text, to figure out what spells I wanted.
Right. But it's a small ding on what is otherwise a system that I think we both really, really, really like.
And have run several times, and we will likely keep running it.
Yeah.
So Tanner, absolutely. That first time we played, what adventure did you run?
I ran a one-page adventure, a one-page dungeon called Temple of the Moon Priests. And Dusty's going to link that in the description of this episode if you want to check it out. It's available for free online. I believe it was an entry into a one-page dungeon contest several years ago. There, I always kind of check the winners of those one-page dungeon contests because they're cool. I want to give all credit to Will Doyle and Stacy Allen, and it is published by Gildor Games. And yeah, we'll put the drive-through link on there, but if you search for Temple of the Moon Priest one-page dungeon or something like that, you will find it as well, and it is free. But yeah, I wanted to really limit my scope. I have run this dungeon once before several years ago for my partner, and it's a cool one. And yeah, you really liked the setup of it, right?
I did, yeah. It's as you told me about the quest that brought me to this dungeon, the setup was so simple and so effective. It was, hey, you know what? You're a dangerous person trying to get a mysterious thing from a dangerous place. And guess what? There's other dangerous people who are also trying to get this thing. Go.
Yeah. So the basic story of the adventure is, the king's dying words hint at a piece of the sky shard, which is hidden in this ancient temple of the moon priests. And you are not the only adventurer in search of it. So there are other adventurers in the site, which I always love when you meet other adventurers in games. You know, it's a fun way to add color to the setting.
And in fact, pretty much the only combat, not the only combat, but pretty much the only combat were against the other adventurers, the Knucklebones.
The Knucklebones, yeah. I want to, before we get too far, I do want to shout out the amazing art of this. I mean, it's really just a pleasure to look at, and it's usable, which I think is a very rare combination when it comes to like gaming maps and things like that. Unfortunately, Dusty couldn't see it until we were all done with the adventure, but I was just enjoying it. I mean, it's a style that I really like. It's all blues and purples and everything, so yeah.
Since you mentioned it now that I couldn't see it until we were done, I have to say, the experience of playing this dungeon and then afterwards you sending me the PDF and me being able to like look through it and read it and get really into it and see where you changed it, that was so neat. That's such an instructive thing. If you're listening and you're a GM and you know that your GM just ran something pre-prepared, ask for it. Ask to look at it. Or ask what it is and then go buy your own legal copy. But reading something for the first time after it's been run for you, as a forever GM, I rarely get that experience. This is one of the first times I've ever been able to do that. Not the first time, but I think maybe literally the second time. And that was very instructive.
Yeah, it's almost like seeing a public speaker or something like that, and then being able to look at their 3x5 note cards that they had on hand or something. You know, it's a look into, and like you said, like it is a one page dungeon, so the descriptions are pretty sparse. It's a picture of a waterfall, and it says a frail rope scales the cliffside left by long dead priests. That's it. And then, you know, it is interesting to kind of get in the mind of a GM and say, okay, you know, once you had the experience of dealing with that obstacle, then you could see and see how it was in actual play. Then you could go back and see, you know, what did Tanner make up? What did I fill in? You know, which you have to do. That's kind of the fun part of these one-page dungeons, and that's why they're engaging to me as a GM, where it's just enough of an outline that, you know, it's not like a room has like every room has a two-paragraph description like you get in some really onerous, you know, old school dungeons or something like that. Like, they're blurbs, they're flashy art, and then they give you just enough that the dungeon makes sense and is coherent, but it lets you as the GM, you know, run with it and fill in all the blanks and color in between the lines.
So I gave you some feedback earlier. Now I'll pay you a compliment. I hung up from that game like, wow, he really had that thing memorized, because every room, everything I did, everything I said, the answer was just on the tip of your tongue. Like, it really felt like you had massively, massively prepared. And I knew even as I hung up that part of that is just it's a one page and you were ad-libbing and just ad-libbing really effectively. But you do a much better job than me of maintaining the persona of the GM, where like everything the player says, I'll openly be like, oh, I didn't think of that. Give me a second. Whereas you, like a better improv actor, smooth over that, and you don't let the player see those chinks in the armor. So you nailed that on this dungeon.
Well, I'll thank you for your compliment, but I do want to give credit to the dungeon. I mean, the actual way it's written is really consistent. It's coherent. Each description is no longer than a tweet for every room or hazard or character or anything like that. So, I mean, it's a one-page dungeon. You can read the whole thing top to bottom in 5 minutes and then read it again and think about it maybe for 5 minutes. And that's your prep, you know, like, I don't know. I don't want to take all credit for that, but you know,
no, they did it. They did a great job. And every room is thematic. Mm-hmm. Like the whole moonlight motif, you know, it's nighttime, moonlight plays a factor. There's lots of silver metal. The Knucklebones are your consistent adversary. Like, the whole thing felt very it wasn't a funhouse dungeon with monsters that had nothing to do with each other from room to room. It was a very coherent, but still surprising in parts, dungeon with a puzzle. And they did a great job. You're 100% right.
Yeah, and then we were kind of talking about the smaller scale of this thing means that there's not really like a wandering monster table. There's not like there are three goblins in this room, fight. So most of your adversaries were either intelligent foes or things that you might not know were intelligent but are. Do you want to talk about that, kind of like talking your way through versus fighting? Because you did a fair bit of both.
So Bellman, I can't talk about this without getting into the next section, which is the character Bellman. So for me, I know, as I rarely get to play outside of Martin's game, and I know dungeons are about like getting stuff. And I thought, man, it'd be so fun to play as a character. And I'll often anchor on an actual character that I'm familiar with from media, because it gives me a very strong sense of who that person is, and I can play something totally outside my normal play style. And that character in this case, and I feel like I'm going to mispronounce his name, from Raiders of the Lost Ark, kind of Indy's evil counterpart, either Bellick or Belosh. I think it was Bellick. That character, kind of the evil Indy who's dressed a little nicer, maybe doesn't want to get dirty, is a little bit ruthless. That was my inspiration for Bellman. And you mentioned talking my way through. I tried to use Bellock's from Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's got some personality. He's a talker. He can do a little bit of talking. He can't stop himself from being a ruthless bastard.
Right.
But he'll do a little bit of talking, and he might try to turn on the charm a little bit. So yeah, I introduced myself to several knucklebones, some of which I subsequently killed, and others of which I subsequently couldn't bring myself to kill because I'd rescued them. So I simply tied them up and hoped that they didn't starve to death when I left them in the dungeon tied up.
Yeah, but one cool thing, I kind of want to circle back to anchoring yourself to a character. I think that's such a good thing to do if you're trying to kind of find a character. And one thing that you do that I like is that you're unconsciously particular about which characters you anchor yourself to, because it would be very easy to anchor yourself to a character and base your character off. My guy is Tony Stark, or my guy is the man with no name, Clint Eastwood. But you don't pick a leading man to anchor your character off. You know, you go to a villain or a side character like Bellock, who's a main character, a major character in the film. He's an antagonist, but he probably only has 15, 20 minutes of screen time in the whole movie, you know? So there's just enough to anchor. I like that word, anchor you there, but it does leave you free to kind of discover who Bellman is. You're not suddenly tied to, as if you picked Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones for your character, right?
Yeah, and you ask yourself, like, hey, in between these scenes in Indiana Jones, Bella can't be a total jerk. Like, he's got to be nice to some people, right?
Yeah.
Like, who's he nice to? What's he like? But have you noticed that I tend, not always, but I tend to choose villains?
I think that's I haven't noticed it consciously, but it makes sense, right? I mean, you're doing, in these old school games, you're kind of doing villainous activity, you know? You're busting into places, you're swindling people, you're killing monsters, you're taking their stuff, and it's fun.
When you ran Mike, Brian, and I through Holy Matrimony, do you remember who I anchored on?
Yes, you were Worf, weren't you?
No, I was Shredder.
Oh, yeah, you were Shredder. Who was
Uruku Saki is, yeah, Shredder's actual name. So I was whatever the lion family name is. I took Uruku as my given name to so in my mind as a lion, I was Shredder.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and like you said, it's a villain, but it's somebody, I mean, like, let's be real, Shredder doesn't have a ton of personality, but it's enough to get you going. It's flavor, it's an anchor, and then you are free to branch out in whatever direction you want from there, right?
Dude, 1987 cartoon Shredder's got a ton of personality.
Oh, does he?
Oh, yeah.
I've only seen Secrets of the Ooze in the third one, unfortunately.
This is where it shows that I am in my 40s and you have just started your 30s.
Yeah, yeah. So, one thing that is a little bit interesting is that we, for this first one, and we kind of experimented with this later, but for this first one, you were doing a dungeon exploration that was purely theater of the mind, right? I didn't provide you any visual aids. It's a pretty simple dungeon layout. It's basically a ring with some side rooms, kind of, if you really want to look at it. But I was definitely giving you descriptions like, to the north, there is a staircase. To the west, there is an archway. And I think that I think we got better about this, and we realized maybe that that wasn't really cutting the mustard. I think part of the reason we wanted to start the series talking about our games is that later on in several episodes, we'll talk about a structure for exploration that we kind of invented, that you invented, I should say, that really, really do work for us. So I do kind of see this as sort of our first step of realizing that, you know, just pure theater of the mind dungeon exploration, even in a simple dungeon that's, let me count here, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 rooms, 5 of which are in a basically a ring, and then there are some side rooms outside that ring. Like, even then, like, it was a lot of clarification, and that's not on you not remembering or me. I think it's just the nature of the beast, even for a super simple dungeon, like remembering what's up, what's down, you know.
That was the worst part of a very great game, is several times, like, you'd be describing stuff and I'd be closing my eyes, and I'm doing my best to, like, as a player, do all the things that I wish my players would do. And they often do. I'm not saying they don't, but, like, I was giving you my full attention. I was closing my eyes. I'm trying to visualize everything, because then I can put Bellman there. And, like, what would Bellman do? Is he afraid of the dark? Is he not afraid of the dark? Nah, he's an antiquarian. But, like, everything you describe, I'm running it through the filter of, like, Bellman. And I'm trying to do this thing where I'm trying to be my character. But then there's also, in old school dungeons, this kind of graph paper thing you have to do. And I didn't have graph paper in front of me, so I'm just trying to hold the dungeon in my head.
Right.
And I failed miserably. And I think I could see, not frustration, but maybe some mild annoyance on your face a couple times. And I'm like, so wait, so there's nothing to the north? And you're like, no, there's a door to the north. And I'm like, oh.
And right.
I get turned around.
And that's not even so much on you. You know, part of the duties as a GM is to kind of prep materials that would be appropriate and helpful for the game, right? So it's like, mapping a dungeon is one of those things that it kind of could have fallen on either of us as a responsibility to make that clear. But I mean, I'm not pointing blame at either of us. I think going into this, I didn't think either of us anticipated it would be a problem, you know, and it kind of was. It wasn't a huge problem because I'm really not stingy. I mean, I'm not a gotcha GM when it comes to that sort of thing. I'm like, oh, but you walked into a wall. You know, like, I'm not going to do that to you because your character is in there. But one thing that kind of made me think about when you just said, like, kind of getting into character, trying to imagine it in your mind, it would be so disorienting to be in a real life dungeon. Like, even, you know, like, I don't, your character Bellman is maybe a little bit sharper than either you or I, but even then, like, being in an underground complex with kind of hard landmarks, lots of right hand turns going up and down, you know, you were doing the method acting thing of trying to keep it in your mind, but I think it would be hard, you know, if you or I were thrown into a dungeon, right?
So Susan, my wife, and I live pretty near the Linville Caverns. And one of the things we did during the pandemic, because they were doing socially distanced groups and we would go on these outdoor excursions, we went into the Linville Caverns. And I'm such a nerd, I didn't say anything to my wife about it, but I spent the whole time being like, this would be like a dungeon crawl. And dude, it's so dark. And after you're like, the Linville Caverns are not wildly extensive, or at least the tour part certainly isn't. But if I didn't have that tour guide, like, None of those turns are 90 degrees. They're no. Random angles, and you would get turned around so fast.
Yeah, and I by training and trade, I'm a geologist, and I have specialized in the shapes of subsurface things and structural geology, and I have a good mind for this sort of 3D subterranean stuff. And even then, I'm like, man, the human mind just really isn't, you know, equipped to deal with that kind of environment, really, which is what makes dungeons fun. You know, they're dangerous just inherently, but dangerous, frustrating to run. You know, there's a line between there that you got to pick.
But I'm glad you brought this up, because like you said, we get better at this. So if you're listening and you're looking for, like, an arc for these next several episodes, this is the arc. The arc is Tanner and I enjoying old school dungeon crawls, where you're in a dungeon, you're not in the wide open, you're not playing, you know, an improv game with a ton of like acting and NPCs and political stuff. It's not political. It's a dungeon crawl. It's in a dungeon and getting better and better and better at that. And we try, and you'll hear in episodes, a number of different things to get better at visualizing the space. And that's the arc of the next several episodes and the thing that we think we really have to share.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, you know, it's no secret that both you and I do like those kind of political games and mysteries and intrigue and stuff like that. I mean, I've run tons of games like that, and you've been in a couple of them, and they've been awesome, but this is really kind of stretching a new muscle, sort of. It's working out a new muscle, which is a very specific type of RPG muscle, which is this sort of old school dungeon crawl style play.
So a couple questions to you about my style of play, because I think a lot of podcasts and us included, we focus on like the GM's point of view, but let's give some player feedback or some thoughts on how the player did. So I'm going to rapid fire you kind of several questions around how I played Bellman.
Sure.
One, I decided kind of on the fly that Bellman didn't really care for people, but kind of had a soft spot for animals and was reluctant to kill animals. And I was trying to make sure, like, I didn't want to be a psycho.
Sure.
Was that a character trait that you thought, this is interesting and Dusty's playing it well, or was it like a bit psychotic and weird?
It was definitely not psychotic. I think you never strayed too far into being like a real kind of like sociopath about it. Like Bellman just had a preference, right? But it was never to the point where he was like openly hostile to, you know, an NPC that he was talking to for no reason, kind of. You know, he played the game, but I think that's a good choice, because like, I mean, certainly for this adventure, these knucklebones, these other adventurers, you shouldn't have trusted them, and you didn't. And especially for a one-on-one game, like, I'm glad that you didn't suddenly try to seek out and form a party of other NPCs that I would have had to run or something, you know? So I think it's a good instinct, and it never got to the point where like you were always moving forward. You had a thing, you know, you had a go-to decision for any sort of point that you gave, you know, you had Bellman's preferences. And I think that was awesome. It definitely didn't veer into any sort of problematic territory. I think it was an interesting character choice, and it fit the setting in the games that we were running.
So you said Bellman's always moving forward, and that's a perfect segue into my next question. We both discovered, me as I uncover Bellman's personality, that Bellman's incredibly goal-oriented. Bellman gets in a dungeon and he blitzes through that dungeon. And
yeah,
I think of a good player trait as like being decisive and like going off in a direction and not lingering too long and overthinking stuff.
Yeah.
But you made the comment once about, man, you're really goal-oriented. What do you think about Bellman being goal-oriented? Is that easy to run for, fun to run for, or a little hard to run for?
I don't think it's particularly easy or hard. It is fun though. I mean, like when you can't play this like a Skyrim dungeon, right? Where you go into every room and you pick up everything and you put up everything in your inventory. That works for video games, but for, like you weren't a completionist about a lot of these dungeons, and maybe we'll get into those in future episodes, but there's a lot of rooms that you just straight up didn't engage with, or you saw danger. And maybe there was something hidden, but you're like, nah, this isn't what I'm here for. And you moved on. And I think that choice you really only have the freedom of choice and to not be railroaded when you have the ability to choose to not engage with something, right? You know, like if to make it really simple, if there's a split in the path and there's left and right, like, I'm trying to rethink what I'm trying to say here, but do you know what I mean? Like your choices to not engage with certain things and to keep your eye on the prize is a form of player expression. And it is a form of choice making that, you know, if you felt obligated to 100% completionist every dungeon, I don't think it would have been a more interesting game. And I don't think it would have been a better expression of you as a player.
So my last question about Bellman and my play style. At the end, when I had completed the dungeon and I felt like cleared it of relatively all the danger, I said to you, okay, sorry, Tanner, I can't help but to do this. you've said this dungeon's full of silver. I've lifted up a portcullis that's made of silver bars. There's been silver here, silver there. And Bellman is going to take all that silver. Bellman's going to go to town. He's going to hire a cart. He's going to do whatever he needs to do to take all that silver. But I recognized what I was doing. And it was in character for Bellman, but I didn't want to be that guy who's like, well, it's in character and now I'm rich. Ha ha ha. I tricked you, GM. You said silver and now I'm rich. I knew I was doing that. So I said, hey, do me a favor. I'm taking all the silver. Bellman needs to be the type of character where it's all going to be gone by the next time we play because of like poor investments and stuff. As I was explaining this whole concept to you at the end of that first game, did you have an arc where you were like, oh my God, here we go. Oh, thank God. Okay.
Yes, a little bit. I think that kind of play only works with when you did say, hey, I'm doing this because this is what Bellman would do, but out of character, let's say by the next adventure, he's lost it all and squandered all his money, so he's still hungry and ready to go on the next adventure. That is the sign, I think, of a great player to, like, you're preemptively trying to work with me, which is good. I'm trying to think of how I would rule that if you didn't say that. And, I mean, so the idea with old school games is that, you know, you're generally in a dungeon to get treasure and get stuff. And once you have enough stuff to live comfortably the rest of your life, to go back into a dungeon, you either you have some sort of issue that your character has to go back into a dungeon, or they just retire, right? Like you have several hundred pounds of silver that's going to last your character for a long time, right? So it's kind of hard to rule that. And I would have had to just, if you didn't go that way, I would have had to have an out of character conversation and be like, okay, well, do you want to play Bellman next time? Because the way I'm seeing it right now, he's probably set for life, you know? So I'm glad you kind of preempted it with saying, hey, this is all just kind of for flavor because this is what Bellman would do. But, you know, I mean, a good GM too would say, you know, like, oh, accumulating riches does come with its own problems. And suddenly, you know, maybe the Knucklebones' family is going to come after you, or, you know, it's not discrete wealth. You're carrying huge things of silver in. So maybe that's a hook for a next game. Someone tries to steal it from you, but then you kind of have to, it's hard not to be a dick as a GM to like take away a win from a player. You know, it's a fine line between giving complications to wins and letting the win be a win, you know?
Yeah. I think OSRs do a good job of there's many types of TV shows, but for the sake of argument, let's say there's two. There's TV shows where they're basically long miniseries, and at the end of every episode, the plot has inexorably moved forward and the world has changed. And then there's TV shows where at the end of the episode, things are kind of back to where they were before. And you could watch the show in almost any order, you know, save actor changes and character changes. But within a season, certainly, you can watch in any order, and they end up right where they start. And I think OSR is great for the latter. It's great for your characters end up kind of where they started. Maybe they've leveled up, but they still need money, and they still need riches, and they still need magic items. And the monsters have leveled up too, by the way, so the danger's still there. I think OSR is very episodic versus a saga.
Sure. And I mean, I know that there are people who have had saga style games where the characters accumulate wealth and they build a castle and they hire retainers and they become the lords of the land. And then another, like, that is a totally valid style of play, but it's way more demanding for this type of game in my mind. Like, I mean, that's kind of what your game with Martin is, right? Like you're kind of that one.
It is on the one hand a saga, but at the same time, it's a saga of very similar plot points. Like the whole game that we played with him that took place in, I've forgotten, Dehanan. Dehanan was this world that he built. It was an island hopping campaign. Like we were on a ship and we kind of went from island to island. So every session or every adventure was us arriving on an island, figuring out what this island's like culture and kind of thing was, getting into some trouble, getting into some scrapes, getting some rewards, getting back to our ship, getting off the island. And then the next plot is kind of the same thing.
Yeah. It's like Star Trek almost, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think either one can work. But I do think that a saga style game over an episodic game certainly requires more investment and more work for both both players and GMs. And I think that that's kind of not what we were looking for. We were looking for a kind of fun, you know, not necessarily stupid, but like, you know, a fun popcorn dungeon of the week type game that we can glean some lessons from and get better at. It was great. And I like that we figured out a way for your character to kind of return to the status quo, maybe obviously leveled up, maybe got some new gear and a magic item here or there, but you know, effectively you were kind of back at the status quo when it came to being at the door of the next dungeon,
ready for the next adventure.
Yeah.
So to sum up this episode with a couple of recommendations / lessons learned, play Scarlet Heroes. If you're looking for your next game and you want to do some old school stuff and play some old school dungeons, but you can't get a large group together and you can only get, you know, maybe one other person, Scarlet Heroes is perfect. And if you're looking for, yeah. And if you're looking for that first dungeon to run, Temple of the Moon Priests is killer good.
Yeah, yeah. We go to some dungeons a little bit later that I think I like better, but for Temple of the Moon Priest, I mean, what it's asking of you is so little. It's a one-page dungeon and there's so much there that I can't not recommend that along with the system.
Awesome. Well, if you stay this far, thank you for listening, and Tanner, I'll talk to you next time.
Sounds good. Thank you, Dusty.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.